begin our session, I want to just go over some ground rules that we as a community have decided work well for all of our sessions together. Because our topics can generate a lot of heated discussion, which is just fine, we want to make sure that we create an atmosphere that is safe for everyone and an atmosphere where people can trust that we can learn from you and you can learn from us. We've established some ground rules. One is that everyone who participates in a respectful manner, addressing one another with respect, as opposed to personal attacks, you know. We also ask that you use appropriate language when describing gay and lesbian people. Feel free to use the term gay or lesbian or homosexual, whatever you're most comfortable with. When it comes time to getting your questions or comments, we kind of are on the alert for gender parity, and so we like to alternate male-female, male-female, and to give as many people a chance to speak as possible. We want to assure you that all questions that you ask in good faith with a sincere desire to learn are valid questions. So don't be shy about asking questions. And at the same time, it may be that you might ask a question that would be more appropriate for us to pursue with you privately or individually. And if that's the case, we'll just tell you so. If you want to make a statement as opposed to asking questions or make comments, that's just fine. We just ask that you limit yourself to about 2 minutes so that as many people as want to participate can. And I think that pretty much covers our ground rules. I'm going to turn it over to Jeff now. Phyllis Zilhart, our colleague, will be joining us hopefully momentarily. She's on Dish Team, so she's going to be a little bit late.
You may start the tape. Welcome to our session, Homophobia in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. My name is Jeff Johnson, and I'm the assistant pastor at First United Lutheran Church in San Francisco, and I'm on staff at Lutheran Lesbian and Gay Ministry with my colleagues, the Reverend Phyllis Zilhart, who is on Dish Team, and the Reverend Ruth Frost, who are assistant pastors at St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco. We've been here about a week at Holden Village, and throughout that time, we've done a lot of storytelling. We started about a week ago telling our own personal stories and kind of have done that throughout the week. Today, we want to talk a little bit about a political story and a community story, and to talk about institutional discrimination within the church, the ELCA. We want to talk about that from our perspectives, and we want then to encourage, open it up for discussion so that we have a bunch of other perspectives here also. I want to start with this story way back in the fall of 1987. When there were three openly gay seminarians at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary who were certified as openly gay seminarians, certified for the ordination in the LCA and the ALC. The committees who did this certification knew that these three gay men, Joel Workin, Jim Lancaster, and myself, were gay. We came out to the committees, and with that knowledge, they decided that they wanted to certify us for ordination, that was not something that was going to be a bar to our proceeding in the ministry. We were not asked any questions about our practice. We were not asked any questions about compliance to any policy. At that time, there was no official policy in either of the two predecessor churches. There had been social statements that had been written a couple of years earlier that talked about a policy regarding homosexuality, but there was no, or that talked about kind of ideas regarding homosexuality, but there was no official policy regarding the ordination of candidates. We at that time knew of many lesbian and gay male pastors in the church. We at that time knew that there were bishops of both of the predecessor churches who were providing safe havens for lesbian and gay pastors. And so there were perhaps places for us. We had not, though, heard of an instance where there had been seminarians certified for ordination with the committee's knowledge that people were gay. So we were very excited. Shortly after the formation of the ELCA, January of 1988, the year of our graduation from seminary, a press release went out from Lutherans Concerned to the Los Angeles Times and to a couple of other papers around the country announcing this this great thing that had just happened within these old churches. And it was announced kind of to the United States that there had been openly gay people certified for ordination. 11 new bishops in the ELCA in regions 1 and 2 were pretty upset that this was something that kind of the whole world was finding out about. And they called a special meeting and decided that our certifications, unlike the certifications of all of our colleagues in our class, our certifications had to be questioned because we had not been asked specific questions about our practice. And so we were called into a meeting on March 24th, 1988, a day that will live, that is seared into my memory. And we were asked, this was a meeting with three bishops and representatives from the Division for Ministry in Chicago. And we were asked two questions. Were we at that time practicing homosexuals, and did we plan to be practicing homosexuals in the future? We wanted to talk about those questions. We wanted to talk about the tradition as it kind of dealt with those questions. We wanted to talk about our spirituality. We wanted to talk about ethics. And we were allowed about an hour to talk about all of these things, and then the bishops and the representatives from Chicago said, now we don't want to talk anymore. We simply want your answers to these questions, yes or no. Are you currently practicing homosexuals, yes or no? And do you plan to be practicing homosexuals in the future? What was so very difficult about that meeting is that one of the bishops who was sitting there asking us these questions was a bishop that we knew to be our friend. He was a bishop who had on staff a gay man who was an ordained Lutheran clergy person for whom he had performed a holy union. And we knew that this bishop was a friend, and he was asking us questions about our practice, refusing to talk about his participation in the lives of so many lesbian and gay people up to that point. After that meeting, there were a couple of months that passed, and by June of 1988, the three of us, because of our answers to the questions, were deemed to be, actually our certification was not revoked because there's not a way to do that in the church. We were simply not recommended for call by each of our respective bishops. Joel and Jim at that meeting refused to answer both questions. I answered the first question saying, no, I wasn't a practicing homosexual at the time. And I answered the second question by saying, I wasn't currently in a relationship, but I plan to be in a relationship. And when that time came, when I deemed sexual expression to be appropriate within the context of my gay relationship, I would call my bishop. And I would say, you know, it's time. And they were satisfied with that answer in March. But by June, they weren't satisfied with that answer. What happened between January and March, and between March and June? Publicity. The issue became hotter. The issue had gained more kind of national attention. And so what had been up to that point a gentleman's agreement between bishops and seminarians, or bishops and ordained people, a gentleman's agreement which said and continues to say, it's okay if you're lesbian and gay as long as no one knows about it. Or, it's okay if you're lesbian and gay as long as only very few people know about it. That agreement was being challenged because of the publicity around this issue. June 1988, all three of us were not going to be recommended for parishes and decided that we ought to start looking for other work. Joel and Jim moved to Los Angeles and entered different professions, and I stayed in the Bay Area and was on staff with Lutheran Social Services. A very interesting thing then happened. 40 pastors in the San Francisco Bay Area got together, and they said, this is unjust. This new unofficial policy that's being enforced is unjust. And they started having discussions which lasted about a year and a half with the bishop and with congregations and doing a lot of organizing, so that they came to the point in about the summer of 1989 that they wanted to do two things. They wanted to find places for openly lesbian and gay pastors, congregations for openly lesbian and gay pastors, and they wanted to establish a ministry of affirmation, spiritual care, and support for lesbians and gay men in the Bay Area. At that point, they only had one candidate. They had a gay male candidate. I had said that I would be interested in such a position. But to do a really effective job at some kind of ministry in the Bay Area, it was necessary to have a lesbian counterpart. And so we initiated a national search for a lesbian person who would come out into this position. And that's where you jump in. But before you do that, just an interesting story. The way positions are advertised in the ELCA is through a paper called the ELCA Personnel Referral Bulletin or something like that. And so we decided, well, we're advertising for a position in the church, let's use official channels. We sent in our little job announcement to the ELCA, and I got a call from the editor of this bulletin, and she said, Jeff, I've just read through your position announcement, and I'm concerned. I don't think I can run it. And I said, well, why can't you run it? She said, well, we have guidelines for inclusivity, and the announcement is exclusive. It asks for a lesbian woman. What if other kinds of women want to apply? So I explained to her why we needed a lesbian woman on staff and why it was very important for the type of ministry which we were visioning. And she said, well, that sounds great. I'll run it with that justification. And a month later, our official advertisement appeared in this official organ of the ELCA that went to pastors and churches throughout the country.
You didn't say that you got into a bit of trouble, though.
She did. We got a phone call after this ran, and I guess Chicago was just humming the day that this was printed.
I understand also she got a bouquet of flowers for
she
us
did.
And things.
She did.
My name is Phyllis Zilhart, and I'm a little flustered here. I was just on kitchen duty, scrubbing pots and pans, so I'm a little dish rag here, and I have the cleanest fingernails I will probably have for the rest of my life right now. So, boy, it's hard to know how far back to go here. I come from a small town in Minnesota, about 2,000 people, and the church was a very important part of my growing up. I think, as most of you from small towns know, the church and the school are kind of the main center of life for that community, and that was very true for me and my family. All of my life that I recall, I wanted to be a pastor, and I remember at one point in vacation Bible school, I must have been 6 or 7, and the teacher asked, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? What do you want to do? What do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, well, I wanted to be a pastor. And she said, well, and at that time, we weren't ordaining women. And so she said, well, girls can't be pastors. She said, but you could be a parish secretary. She said, that's almost the same. As a kid, I thought, really? It didn't quite seem true to me, although in my experience since then, I realize it's more true than I thought, for parish administrators do. So it seemed very natural for me. My involvement was very strong in the church, and part of that was a way to deal with some dynamics in my family. My father was an active alcoholic when I was growing up, and my mother was a wounded survivor of incest in her family, and so there was a lot of chaos and shame and craziness in my family that I did not understand, and so the church was very much a haven for me. It was very much a place of sanity and belonging, and a place where I knew I was wanted, and I knew my gifts were cherished. And I think it was really very much a sanctuary, very much a saving place for me, and I will always be grateful for the church for being that for me when I was growing up. What I didn't realize so much at the time, as I look back, I see clues that I was a budding lesbian from pretty little. I have my first memory of noticing girls in a special way when I was about 6 and didn't understand it or put it into any context, and it's probably not unusual for that to happen, but as I connected things through my life, I can see that that's a theme, that wasn't just an odd thing in my life. But it wasn't really until late in my seminary career that I realized that these feelings for women weren't going to go away, and it wasn't just a side point of my life, and I couldn't just pretend that it wasn't there. And it also then, at that point, my senior year, of seminary, just before I was about to be certified, I fell in love with Ruth. And that broke through all of my denial that this was something that I would outgrow or get rid of or whatever. And it was such a strange experience because on the one hand, I felt the most integrity and integration of my life that I had ever felt. My emotional life, my spiritual, intellectual life, and my physical, sexual life was all together. As before, I would try to be in relationships with men and do some dating, and yet all of my close emotional attachments were to women. And it just never quite came together for me. And suddenly, I understood why that was. And it was very much an experience of healing and great affirmation, and really very much a sense of God's grace and call in my life. A lot of things really fit together, and I'm very grateful for that. And Ruth is a great blessing in my life. But it was a very difficult time to be so in love and so awakening and feeling like this was a rebirth experience when I was facing, what am I going to do with this institution now? I was just about to be certified for my final interview, make decisions about would I pursue parish ministry, which I had always wanted to do, and I decided to go ahead with that. My advisor knew, I talked to my advisor about this relationship, and she decided to recommend me for certification anyway, and that went through well, and I got assigned. I ended up being in the Twin Cities area, and Ruth and I had been in relationship for about a year when I graduated from seminary, and got a placement in a position being an interim pastor in a suburb of St. Paul. And interim ministry isn't ordained unless you already are ordained, and yet you can usually do all of the things that a parish pastor does, and with the bishop's approval, which I had, I could do baptisms and every communion and everything that a pastor could do. So virtually, I had this strange privilege of being a closeted clergy for a year without having to go through the ordination process and those vows. So it was a very strange time to have this wonderful part of my life and this very conflicted part of my life. And parish ministry was very important to me, and I think that that experience went well and I appreciated it. But as the year went on, it became more and more crazy, and Ruth had at that time left ministry and was in a position where she was working in chemical dependence at a treatment center for gay and lesbian people. Well, her reality was totally different. They had gay and lesbian clients, gay and lesbian staff. She had my picture on her desk. I was invited to the company picnics. Whereas in my world, in my life, in my work, I had no picture of Ruth on my desk. I talked about, I'm going to do this for the weekend. I'm going to do that. Ruth came in once in a while, but we were just friends. And as that continued, I realized that not only was it denying who I was, not only was it reinforcing that this was not a healthy, life-giving relationship, but it also distanced me from the people in the parish. I couldn't talk about the heart of gospel liberation for myself. I couldn't really be an advocate for justice and wholeness and truth-telling in the world because I couldn't do it for myself. And so the very things that had brought me into ministry, connections with community and living out the wholeness of the gospel in my life, I was able to share less and less with the people that I was working with. Well, finally that became just too difficult, and that job ended after a year anyway. And at that point, I went in and talked to my bishop, Mole Erdahl, in Minnesota, and I brought Ruth with me, and Ruth's father and Lowell were very good friends, personal friends. And I said, I cannot do this anymore. I'm a lesbian. I'm in a relationship that is life-giving, that God willing will be for a lifetime. It's a committed relationship. I cannot live this crazy, divided, conflicted life. And therefore, I'm asking you to remove my name from those eligible for placement and call. And he said, well, why have you told me this? And I again repeated, well, it's this crazy life, and I kind of explained it again, and it's just two nuts, lol, I can't do it. And he said, well, I really wish you hadn't told me this. He said, you know, there are other ways that we could have worked this. Meaning what Jeff was saying, that as long as you know but you don't talk about it, as long as you don't say the words directly, it's okay. And I just thought, you know, that just reinforces the shame. I mean, it doesn't really get you out of the bind of claiming your wholeness. It just means that you live in a larger closet, but it still doesn't change that dynamic. And so I just again said, well, you know, it was too late. I had spoken it, and that was the truth of my life. And he said, well, now that you have said that, I'll have to act on it. And of course, I'll have to remove your name. And then he started to talk about what did it mean to tell the truth and what did it mean to tell a lie in a system that was corrupt. And he gave the example of if there isn't a way, if there's no way to honestly answer a question, if it's not a two-sided question, if it's a catch-22, you don't have the same obligations of truth-telling if it's an open, honest question. And he gave the example of Nazi Germany and saying that when people were hiding Jews in their homes in the resistance, and if someone came to them, if the Nazis came and asked, are you hiding Jews in your home? They were justified in saying, well, no, we're not. That in a corrupt, evil system, the proper thing to do is to lie. But that's the way to preserve the whole. And so he said that basically, if there isn't a way to tell the truth, then that's the way you live with that. Okay. Well, to liken the system of our church to that of Nazi Germany, and to have the church in the position of the corrupt system where you cannot tell the truth, seemed very odd. But now that I had told the truth, he couldn't lie. He was, of course, now obligated to carry through on this. And so I gave up ministry at that point, moved into working with children affected by AIDS, and had really given up on ministry until 3-4 years later, Ruth and I got a letter on our doorstep from this LLGM outfit asking if we were interested. They were looking for a lesbian candidate, and so Ruth and I applied, and things moved on from there.
Well, I guess I have to start with my senior year in seminary, and I'll try and do this quickly. As Phyllis indicated, falling in love in our senior year of seminary certainly presented us with some difficult dilemmas. I too had always wanted to be a pastor, and I'm third generation clergy. My dad, as many of you know, was a Lutheran Northwestern Seminary professor. His name is Gerhard Frost. And he's taught over 2,000 of the Lutheran pastors out in the parish currently. So I come by the interest naturally. I struggled with the whole issue of sexuality and spirituality all through seminary, and basically what I did with it was compartmentalize my life and just made a split between the two. But my senior year, everything came to a head, and I had to make a decision. And by that time, I was 35 years old. I'm 43 now. And I had been closeted all those years, completely closeted from my family, completely closeted from friends, and had discovered that the closet breeds secrets, and secrets breed shame. And that the relationships that I was having with people were one-way relationships, where I knew them, but they didn't know me. And it was pretty unsatisfactory and pretty dishonest. I would say the turning point came, and I've mentioned this before, but I think it's pertinent for those of you who haven't heard it. The turning point came for me when I was assigned to the New York metro area. I had been certified in the LCA, and I had switched to the LCA so I'd be in a major metro situation where I knew there would be other gay and lesbian people, and I wouldn't be quite as lonely. And so I was assigned to the New York metro area, and I was set up to meet with the New York metro bishop, James Grafe. And I was told by seminary people, students, as well as one faculty person that I was out to, not to come out to him because he was, in this faculty person's words, very homophobic, and it would not be safe. And so, even though there were lots of closeted gay and lesbian clergy in the New York metro area, so I met with Bishop Grafe, and we had a long talk. He looked over all my credentials, and we hit it off very well. But he knew that I had been married and divorced, and so he asked me about that. And I told him only half of the truth, which was that I had married a gay man and that the relationship hadn't worked out. And at that point, he thought that I would be a great candidate in his district because he said a major problem that he had at that time was gay pastors who would come out while in their parishes and leave their wives. And he felt that there was a needed ministry to these wives that were being left by their gay husbands. He said, it's a very difficult dilemma for me, he said, because, you know, if they don't come out to me and they're not out to their parishes, I cannot advocate for them when this happens. And I thought, well, gee, maybe this man isn't as homophobic as I've been told, and maybe he would be someone I could trust. And I said, well, have you ever had a gay or lesbian person come out to you and be assigned in your district to a parish? And he said, no, and it will never happen. So, you know, another little catch-22. So I thought, okay. And we left. He gave me a big hug, welcomed me to that synod, said, I've got a parish in mind for you. I'll be giving you a call in about a month. And I left that interview and walked out onto the streets of Fifth Avenue right as the Lesbian and Gay Freedom Day parade was marching down Fifth Avenue with hundreds of thousands of gays and lesbians carrying placards that read, I'm gay and I'm proud. And I stood there looking at those placards and thought, I can't tell my church I'm gay or lesbian. At that time I wasn't using the L word. And I certainly can't say that I'm proud. And it just confronted me with the schizophrenia of the situation. And so when I got back to Minnesota, I called him up and I said, I'm taking a year to do some specialized training for the ministry. I'm going to take a year to do training in the field of chemical dependence, which was the truth, but again, only half the truth. I wasn't quite ready to say, hi, remember me, I'm the lesbian you talked to. Anyway, so I took that year to think. And I also took that year in the Masters of Ministry and Social Change program at seminary. And it was a program that had 9 students in it. And I came out to that group of 9 people because I knew that I needed 1 year in seminary where somebody knew me. And it turned out to be a very healing year. And it helped me to decide that I couldn't go ahead with my plans for ministry and hope to have a healthy, happy, open life where I could know people and be known. And so, as Phyllis indicated, I left the ministry, and I got this job in this chemical dependency treatment center with gay and lesbian people. And my world flipped from being totally closeted in largely heterosexual milieus. I was totally open in a largely gay lesbian milieu. And for the first time, my life was normed. For the first time, I could feel what it was like to be part of mainstream culture that was affirming. And that was life-changing for me. That was really rebirth and resurrection. In that time period, Phyllis and I had an affirmation of commitment celebration, and we'll talk more about those personal stories later on. But 5 years went by then, and then this notice of LLGM looking for a lesbian pastor. And Phyllis and I looked at this and we thought, really? Man, this is unusual. This is really unusual. What an opportunity. And we thought, well, should we apply? And we kicked it around a little bit and we'd really given up ministry. In fact, in some ways, we'd given up the church. And we thought, well, let's one more time. Let's let this be kind of the last ditch effort to work within the system, sort of, and try to do ministry in the Lutheran Church. And if we don't get the position, we'll say goodbye to the Lutheran Church finally once and for all and switch to the UCC. And so we did, and lo and behold, we did get this position. As we were packing, getting ready to leave, it became very apparent that this was going to hit the press and become a very hot issue. In fact, it had already started to hit the press before we moved to San Francisco from Minnesota. And so I thought, I've got to talk to my seminary community because they don't know me. I mean, all of a sudden there's this Lutheran scandal. And so I called up the dean and said, asked if I could have just a time to have a forum over there with the student body and the faculty, perhaps in an evening. and just explain why I felt this call was so important. All kinds of hoops to try to get that opportunity to talk with that community. And finally, the president said, I want to talk with you privately. And we had I said, sure. And I came in and had a private session with him, and it became apparent to me that in the first 2 minutes of the interview that the decision had already been made that I would not be allowed to speak to the community, which was such a strange experience because I was a child of that community. I grew up on that seminary campus. My father taught there over 25 years. I was a student there. Phyllis was a student there. I mean, it seemed logical that we should be able to talk to that community. But in the interview, he said, you know, I understand. I appreciate why you want to talk to the community, but now that you are a public figure, the rules have changed and the child can no longer come home. And he said, that's why this dialogue will not take place. And that was, we went on to talk for about another hour, but that was the end of that attempt. So I've not been able to come home to Luther Northwestern Seminary. I hope someday that I will, but it has not yet happened. And I share that with you to share some of the, so that you can see the fear level that this has engendered. Because if there's anyone that should be able to be, you know, that's sort of obviously grade A Lutheran, it's all three of us. But the church is just terribly, terribly frightened.
We'll do this real quick. On January 20th, there was an ordination in San Francisco where the three of us were ordained and assigned to First United in St. Francis to begin our ministries, which we have done. There were satellite services all over the United States, kind of held in six or seven different locations, one actually happening up here at the Village that corresponded. Some were linked by telephone to the ordination service itself. What is interesting about our story and kind of the political story with the ELCA and the story of Bill Kunisch that we have passed out is that what we're talking about here is a policy that or a situation that is occurring because of lesbian and gay people and our supporters kind of standing up and simply saying, we're not going away, we're here, and we're not going to be denied kind of the access that the church has denied us in the past. You all know the stories of what happened with St. Francis and First United. The day after the ordination on January 21st, the bishop and the secretary of the synod hand-delivered charges to both of those congregations. The charges were that the congregations had violated the church constitution by calling pastors who weren't on the official roster of people eligible for call in the Lutheran Church. 6 months later, in July of 1990, the congregations were put on ecclesiastical trial. The first time that this has ever happened, that two congregations have been called to trial for calling pastors. There was a disciplinary committee convened. People from all over the ELCA came to San Francisco to sit on this 13-member disciplinary committee, and they heard testimony. They heard testimony both from, it was a courtroom, there were prosecutors and there were the accused. Both sides had lawyers, and both sides had
cross-examination, a court reporter.
Kind of objections, kind of normal court stuff. Both sides had lots of witnesses. And it became clear in listening to the witnesses that the witnesses from St. Francis and First United were talking about people and ministry and doing the gospel and acting clearly, and the witnesses for the denomination and for the synod were talking about constitutions and laws and regulations being broken and all of this kind of stuff. The trial lasted for 3 days. The panel deliberated for a couple of days and then rendered a verdict. And the verdict is that the congregations have been suspended from the denomination, which means that the lay people in the congregation have no voice or vote at synod assemblies. The clergy still do. The recognized clergy still do. The congregations have been suspended for 5 years, and at the end of that time, if we're still on staff as pastors of those congregations, and if the ELCA policy has not changed, the congregations will be expelled. What's scary about that trial is that we now have in the church an official policy that lesbian and gay people who do not agree to a lifelong vow of celibacy cannot be considered for ordination if that knowledge is known, if they choose to be open and talk about it.
And can I just interject here for a moment, Jeff? The lifelong vow of celibacy for gay and lesbian people is for us a lifelong vow of shame. Because if you are not ashamed of who you are, and if you are not ashamed of your loving, committed relationships, why should you have to take such a vow? Mm. So for us, it is like accepting and actually participating in a lifelong vow of shame.
And it's
the catch-22 even goes deeper, because there is no way to have a recognized commitment. I mean, there is no equivalent in our church for gays and lesbians being married. And so even if you want to and see yourselves in a committed relationship, there's no way to be recognized as such. You are seen as, no, you're not coupled, you're not committed, you're not partnered, you're not married, however you see yourselves, but no, you are single and you must be celibate.
You are simply practicing. You are always this practicing person.
But they don't want to talk about what practicing means. This not only applies to persons who are lesbian and gay, but it also applies to persons who support and speak positively about lesbian and gay experience. There was a seminarian, Bill Kunisch, who was a second-year seminarian at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley, assigned from the Michigan Synod, who went home to his home parish last December. This is the flyer that each of you have, and preached a sermon in which he talked about Mary and how Mary is an example that we need to follow of one who has been called by God, who has discovered to her great surprise that she has been chosen, and his point was that each of us are chosen to kind of follow God, and God gives us surprises to follow. And he talked about St. Francis Church and how in his experience the people at St. Francis Church are no different from the people throughout the ELCA or the people at the church where he grew up. And that he had learned from the experience of being there at St. Francis that we need to talk about this issue in the ELCA. Because of that sermon that he preached, there was a committee convened composed of the bishop from his synod, representatives from Chicago, his pastor, some church council people, and after a series of meetings, it was decided that he was not a fit candidate for ministry. He was asked questions about his compliance with a new document which has emerged in our church called the Vision and Expectations document. And in this document it says that all people are expected to live, I don't know the exact wordings, but it says that if you're lesbian and gay, there is no sexual expression which is appropriate. If you're straight, the only sexual expression which is appropriate is within the context of marriage. And all seminarians are now asked usually in their fourth year, whether or not they're in compliance with this document. Not only whether or not they're in compliance with this document, but whether or not they support this document. Bill was in his second year. He had preached a sermon, and he was asked these questions at an irregularly called meeting of his candidacy committee.
Prior to that meeting, upon his bishop's recommendation, his financial aid was cut from the congregation, and he was barred from preaching or assisting in worship.
Because of this sermon that he preached in December, where he talked about St. Francis Church. Where am I?
His endorsement committee had basically an emergency meeting.
Right.
They called
right.
him back to meet with them, asked him questions about his sermon for about 2 hours, then asked him the guidelines question,
right.
which was, does he support and is he in compliance with ELCA guidelines?
And Bill's answer was that I refuse to answer those questions at this point because they've been irregularly asked of me, and I will answer them when you can demonstrate to me that you ask all ordained clergy in this church those questions and all seminarians who are in my position. I'm not going to be irregularly singled out here. If you can show me that your claim that you ask everybody this is true, I will answer. The committee then decided that Bill had failed to answer the questions and withdrew his endorsement. A number of things have happened since that time. The faculty at PLTS has voted to allow Bill to continue as an unclassified student at the seminary, which is a show of support. There's a congregation in the United States which has called Bill to be an intern pastor next year, which is a strong show of support. We don't know what will happen to that congregation for the action that they're taking. And there's a committee that's now formed around Bill to ask the question, how is it that we can support this student who has spoken up on behalf of lesbian and gay people? How can we assist him so that he doesn't get washed out of the process in his second year of ministry? I think we need to stop talking now, and I think what we need to do is kind of open it up to questions and discussion. What we're talking about here are cases of institutional discrimination, cases where either being lesbian or gay or speaking on behalf of lesbian and gay people wash people out of the system that we have set up to prepare people for the ministry in our church.
There is one, just a quick explanation of one other sheet that you have. There is another instance that just happened recently concerning an assistant to the Bishop of Wisconsin Synod who was asked to resign when his confidentiality was violated by two people who were in a small group session with him and who learned that he was gay, and they basically exposed him to his bishop. So that's Paul Johnson's case, and we're not going to go into that as deeply tonight as Bill's because we just don't have enough time, but you'll get information on that on the flyer that you've received.
As you kind of hear us talk about this, what are some questions, reactions?
Maybe if you could just clarify for me what Bill's history has been. But I remember I'm a member of Grace University Lutheran in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill was at our church as a contextual ed student. Mm-hmm. I don't know where in seminary that is or when it is.
Mm-hmm. That was when he was a student at Lutheran Northwestern Seminary
before
he transferred to Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary.
Second year he was in Berkeley.
Okay.
And third year usually go on internship, so that's what he's doing next year.
Okay.
He's going on an irregular internship next year. Illegal.
Okay. So I remember one Sunday coming into the narthex right after church, going down to coffee hour, and our pastor always introduces the contextual ed students, and so you kind of know who they are. And our pastor was standing right there, and he said, "Karen and Bruce, why don't you meet Bill?" And so we met Bill, and he flushed so red. Like, oh my gosh, he is so innocent and nice. And we chatted for a little while and just thought, oh, this is going to be nice. We'll get to know Bill a little bit. And to know that this Bill that we met in the hall is Bill now, who is this national figure, I think it's a different experience, because when you look at these three, you may have heard their story before, you may know their names, but for me, and I know them because of national stuff. Mm-hmm. But Bill, I know because he was so shy.
Mm.
And his face stuck in my head like, I hope you're gonna make it as a pastor. I'm a little nervous.
Well, and I think what's important about that story is that Bill is kind of Joe typical Lutheran seminarian.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Michigan. He's somebody who is the pastor. And his sermon was a good sermon. It wasn't spectacular, it wasn't horrible, it was just a good sermon. And the fact that something that he mentioned about St. Francis Church, something that he mentioned about lesbian and gay people, touched off an almost irrational response from the denomination is very frightening. There is no longer in our church room for discussion around this issue, it appears, but people are being silenced and kind of driven out because of what they say.
Mary Jane?
Yeah, Mary Jane.
You know, Donna was
yes.
Brought into it, and she's still in it.
Yes.
But as to this other one, within the church, it was a parishioner that this man really trusted a lot, a small group of three people.
Mm-hmm. Donna Dunsing is the internship director at Pacific Lutheran Seminary, and she has been very supportive. What happened with this congregation that is calling Bill as an interim pastor, they found out that the synod was, or that the national church had withdrawn the endorsement, and they found out that the synod wasn't going to recommend Bill an internship, and they called up the synod and said, "What is this? He was your first choice candidate to us. You know, why aren't you going to send him to us anymore?" And Donna told the whole story to this congregation. The congregation said, "That's a bunch of baloney. You send him, he'll do internship in our parish next year, and then we'll see what happens."
Wait a minute. What did the synod say when they asked that question?
What did the synod say Senator. When...
When they called and said you recommended, this was your first recommendation, now you're withdrawing, what was their response?
Donna's response, because the parish talked to the seminary.
Oh, I see.
Donna's response was, this is what the ELCA has done. This is the decision that the ELCA has made, and Bill's not, you know, he's officially been de-endorsed.
She basically gave them the chronology of
right.
events that you
right.
have before
right.
you.
And the parish pastor said, well, you know, that's something that we can't tolerate. We want him. Yeah.
I don't know if there's official statements on this from you or if you have opinions. Do you think that this response is a response by the synod because of their interpretation of scripture, or do you think it's a response to society's norms or expectations using the law and constitution of a synod? We have that law that you talked about as opposed to gospel, which I've known to be a conflict in other Lutheran struggles.
I think the ELCA has painted itself into a corner. I think there are people of faith who are honestly conflicted about the issue of homosexuality, certainly, and conflicted about the biblical texts and all of that. So I wouldn't want to discount that at all. But there are people of faith who really have honest struggles with this. However, the fact that we have a history in the Lutheran Church of bishops ordaining people that they knew were lesbian and gay, of bishops who know they have lesbian and gay clergy in their districts, but those clergy don't make noise. The fact that bishops have been willing to perform holy unions
for
lesbian and gay clergy, you know, the fact that there are, you know, Lutheran clergy out there right now who perform blessings and unions, but they don't talk to their bishops about it, you know. In other words, it's what we've had is a conspiracy of silence in the past. And as long as nobody would talk about it, then bishops who were sympathetic could turn kind of a deaf ear and a blind eye. But now that lesbian and gay people are basically saying we can't keep closeted, we cannot spend our lives in the closet because it kills us and it breaks up our relationships. It's terrible to have to deny both yourself and a loved one. The church recognizes now that the issue is has come out of the closet. The issue has come out of the closet along with these persons with real names and real faces. And then, so it's the church has scrambled to develop a policy very hurriedly.
Well, and also to answer your question, it seemed very interesting to me that the charges against these congregations were not that they called gay or lesbian pastors.
No.
Those weren't the charges at all. The charges were simply that these two congregations had called persons who were not on the official roster of candidates. And so it became very much a constitutional issue that this is the roster, these are the rules, what can we do? You know, you broke the rules, we didn't make you do that. And so now we just have to follow through. And for quite a while, the National Church and the Sierra Pacific Synod was advocating for a half a day trial to just ask the congregations, did you break the rules? Did you know that we have the authority to make rules? Don't you think you should pay the penalty? That it wouldn't take long. Nobody was denying that we had broken the rules, and so why would it take more than a couple hours to go through that, do the proceeding, and then it would be done? And we were saying, of course we broke the rules, because we see the rules as unfair. We have gone through convention after convention. Lutherans Concerned has worked over 20 years advocating for lesbians and gays in the church, and nothing is happening legislatively. Everybody's turning, as Ruth was saying, the deafness and the blindness. And So we thought it was time to take this kind of a radical action, and we want to tell you why. And the discipline committee was very fair in saying, we will let you tell your story. But the Synod and the National Church did not want that to happen and really tried to block that process. And the people on this committee said, we need to hear these stories and we'll let the committee decide what's relevant and not relevant in terms of all of these issues. So it wasn't a case of biblical interpretation. It wasn't a case of gay lesbian people and experience. It was a sense of constitutional order. And so that tells me that nobody wants to have this church-wide dialogue about theology, sexuality, relationships, authority, power. And so that seemed very revealing to me.
The other thing that happened in the aftermath of the trial, the discipline committee issued a report. And in that report, they wrote an open letter to every member of the ELCA and all the bishops.
How many of you have read that letter?
Where did you read it?
Where did it? I got a copy of it.
You got a copy of it?
You're a pastor?
Yes.
Good. Great.
I think we did, too.
Okay, great.
All right.
What has, in the Sierra Pacific Synod, that letter has been distributed. But it has not been distributed in any other synod.
Northwest Washington.
Pardon me?
Northwest Washington. It's not blanket distributed, but it's available.
It's available. Okay. If people write in, they can get it.
Right.
They
can all get it from the national office.
Right.
But you have to write in to get it. And in that open letter, what the committee did is it summarized the issues that the congregations had raised during the trial. It didn't pick a stance, it just summarized issues. And it also said that the church needed to do a national, thoughtful, church-wide study on the issue of homosexuality and ordination, and that prior studies were not adequate. And the committee said that they picked a 5-year suspension so that there would be at least 2 national assemblies where the issue could come up and be voted on, and so there would be a long period of time for this discussion to take place. The Lutheran Magazine, which would be the logical arm of the ELCA for the distribution of a publication of this open letter, did not publish it until the chair of the discipline committee wrote the magazine and said, you need to publish this letter. At that point, they published excerpts. But most people in the ELCA don't know about the open letter. A lot of pastors don't know about it, and certainly many congregations do not. And what has happened then to this national church study that was supposed to take place is that the bishops have just issued a statement saying that the study on ordination and homosexuality will not begin until possibly 1993, and that it will look only at the issue of ordaining non-practicing gays and lesbians. So we're back to square one. And we all know that studies take 2, 3, 4 years in the church. It's very clear to us that the agenda of the ELCA is to see to it that First United and St. Francis get expelled so that the church never has to deal with those congregations or the three of us. At the last Sierra Pacific Synod Assembly, Bishop Herbert Chilstrom was a guest speaker, and he addressed that assembly of 1,000 people. And at the end of his address, some people asked him questions about Bill Kunisch's case. And he told the 1,000 people assembled, not basically, in so many words, not to worry about that because there was an appeals process for Bill that was going to take place. Bill was at the assembly. He had a letter in his pocket from Joe Wagner,
the head
of the Division for Ministry, saying to him that there would be no appeals process.
That there is no appeals process in the church.
So Bill managed to catch up with Bishop Chilstrom after the address and pulled out the letter and said, I'm confused. You've just told 1,000 people I'm going to have an appeals process, but this letter tells me I'm not. What's the truth? And Chilstrom looked at the letter and said, oh, I guess I misspoke myself.
Bishop Chilstrom also at the assembly before 1,000 people said that there is currently a study on sexuality happening within our church. We don't know yet whether or not that study is going to take up the issue of the ordination of homosexual persons. If that study decides that it's not going to take up that issue, the bishops have said that they will commission the study in 1993. So this issue is kind of, you don't have to worry about this anymore. It's all being taken care of. The study on sexuality, which is currently going on, is not going to deal with the issue of the ordination of homosexual persons. That's almost been public from the very beginning of that study. And so it's very, very disconcerting to the members of our congregations and to those people who are interested in these issues. John?
Jeff, Eldon Olson, who's co-chair of that task force on human sexuality, told our chapter Lutherans Concerned that he had gotten a letter from the ELCA saying that you will not address the issue of ordination in the study. And there was a letter that was sent to them saying, do not touch that issue.
Karen?
Yeah, speaking as a staff director of that, and I worked closely with Eldon on that, I think just to nuance a little bit more some of what you said, our task force was very, you know, the various national actions you've described have been primarily through the Division for Ministry,
right,
which is responsible,
right,
for setting standards, et cetera. So just to make it clear,
right,
where that has come,
right,
from. The other thing that I think is important is to recognize that with all the fervor that broke loose around these issues, our task force was informed that we would not be a group to decide the ordination,
right,
issue. So even though we will be dealing with same-sex relationships, it's clear that whatever we come out with in the social statement that is scheduled for consideration in 93, it's after that that a separate group would be convened to deal with that issue on the basis of what the statement said.
And it was strange to us, listening to Bishop Chilstrom, that he didn't say that. That he said, this decision is to be made within the context of the current study, and once that decision is made, then there has been provision made in case the study does not deal with it. That was...
Jeff,
that
there's
was
a question over here.
Question over here,
time.
Yes.
Curious to what can we do as individuals that our voices can be heard in support of the ordination and how unjust all of this is that is taking place? What can we do?
We have 2 minutes left. So it's kind of a perfect question to ask. It's clear to us that for the ELCA, studying the issue of lesbian and gay persons is not going to settle this issue for us. And there are lots of things that people who are concerned about this can do. You can write. You can write to Chicago. You can write to the bishops who are throwing people out, either for being lesbian and gay or for being supportive of lesbian and gay persons. You can talk to your pastors in your congregations, and you could say things like, well, you know, you could talk about the issue of ordination. You could talk to your church councils. We need to create networks of congregations who are willing to resist the current policy of the church and to do what, for example, St. Francis and First United did last year.
And congregations that are already blessing lesbian and gay relationships or performing holy unions need to come out of the closet.
Yep.
You know, and I also think that, you know, we need to be strategizing more irregular ordinations, frankly, because I just think that until I don't think change is going to happen from the top down. I think it's a grassroots effort. And Bill is a perfect example of someone who would be a great candidate for an irregular call in 2 years after he's had his irregular internship and completed his Master of Divinity degree. Until congregations are willing to take those kind of risks, I don't think we're going to see the walls crumble at all.
Another thing that you can do, I'm sure Jeff and Ruth covered this before I came, but you can support us in prayer. And you can support us with your letters, and you can support us with your checks, and you can support us by visiting us in San Francisco. And our ministry is hanging on a thread financially, and we are very busy. There's so much to do, and we cherish our partnerships with all of you that we have been able to have nationally. It really feels like the resurrection experiences that we have experienced personally are becoming true across the nation, and it's really been our privilege to be able to be very much a part of that, and so we thank you for all of your partnering with us as well.
Thank you.
On that note.
And the tape.
Thank you all for coming. If there is, we have about 15 minutes before Vespers, and if there are people who would like to stay and kind of ask more questions, we would be willing to answer questions for the next couple of minutes.
Thank you. Yes.
Sure.
You can take this, and there should be more over there on the chair. Do you want our list? Our main list? Would you like to? Let me see where that is. Because I think it would be great if you want to. I just want to get that off. Is there a mailing list?
I don't know.